This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Ithaca, New York boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation among 150 waterfalls. Plan your trip today with help from visitithaca.com.
Hi, this is Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we are the co-hosts of Why Food here on Heritage Radio Network.
We've both been huge fans of Heritage Radio since, I don't know, forever. And we are super excited to announce that Heritage Radio is celebrating its 10-year anniversary this year.
10 years of amazing shows, amazing guests, amazing interviews. You have access to all of those things for free, which is pretty incredible. But we are a nonprofit, and we do depend on your support and ultimately your donations to be able to keep doing this.
So we are doing a big donation drive right now, and we would love to see your support. We also have some really great prizes, including
spices from my spice company, Burlap and Barrel. I will curate a set of 6 spices for anyone who feels generous enough to donate in the $500 category.
Go today to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to help support the overall radio network, or you can support us specifically if you click on Why Food in the designation drop-down menu. Thank you so much for listening to Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Lazarus Lynch, entrepreneur, chef, musician, author, and multimedia host. He is a 2-time CHOP champion, host of Food Network Digital Comfort Digital's. Oh my gosh. Wow.
Korsha.
Wow.
It's Korsha.
Hello. Welcome to Hungry Society.
Korsha, don't worry about that bio, girl. Everybody's
No, I need to list that? All of your accolades. I just cannot read today. Okay.
It's a digital series.
Yes, a digital series on the Food Network called Comfort Nation, and author of the cookbook Son of a Southern Chef, Cook with Soul, which we are going to talk all about in a minute. But I want to give you some more praise real quick.
Okay.
And give a little bit more background info. So Lazarus was born and raised in New York City and learned to cook at an early age under the tutelage of his late father, who shared traditional recipes from his family's Southern heritage. Inspired by his father, Lazarus developed a joyful and bold approach to food and a vibrant aesthetic, putting a modern spin on the soul food of his father's kitchen. Lazarus's passion for cooking led him to create the culinary content platform and brand, Son of a Southern Chef, which was a 2017 Savour Blog Awards nominee. You have appeared on the Food Network, NBC, ABC, NPR, BuzzFeed, and TasteMade, The Cooking Channel, The Today Show. You were Snapchat's first chef, Chopped You.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. I had to get all of that out because I need people to know that you were out here working.
Well, I'm out here, but that was totally unnecessary, and appreciate it. It's funny because before I come and do these interviews and conversations, I'm usually like taking the subway or something, or I'm taking the bus, or I'm walking there, and I just, you know, I feel such like a New Yorker, like an everyday, you know, regular New Yorker person, and I don't think of myself as like being this, you know, person who's accomplished so much. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of it. But then I sit down and someone reads off my praises and I just go, oh my God.
You're like, wow. Okay. Yeah.
How did that happen? You know, how did that all happen? So I appreciate it.
I mean, looking at your book, Son of a Southern Chef, I mean, it's kind of clear how it all happened. I mean, you come from a mom and a dad who both had very strong culinary traditions themselves that they passed on to you, and they really seem to show you the importance of eating with your community and people you love and your family and the importance of food in general.
Oh, for sure. You know, I think that I had an experience growing up that maybe some people can relate to, maybe they can't, but it was a big family, 4 brothers and sisters, and a mom and a dad. So at any given time, there were anywhere from 6 people in the household to 8 people because of cousins and family friends. So we were always eating family style. And you can see in the book that a lot of the recipes serve like 6 to 8, 10 to 12, because those were sort of the normal portions and nothing, there were no leftovers. I mean, there's no such thing as that because people would eat it and eat it and eat it. And I grew up with this appreciation for, you know, sharing food with the people that you love, doing what you love for the people you love with the people you love. So, and so I think that that's totally translated into how I think about creating food today and how I think about celebrating recipes for people. You know, it's all about, you know, do people feel happy when they're tasting my food? Are people comfortable? You know, I always love to give people some water or some wine or something when they come to my house because it just makes them feel welcome. And that's exactly the kind of hospitality my parents showed me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your mom was Guyanese.
Yes.
And by way of, you know, Guyana, then London, then... Oh.
She's an interesting person. I will say that to say the least. My mother grew up in Georgetown, Guyana, which is the capital. And for those of you who are listening who don't know, Guyana is north of south in South America, north of Brazil. And it's bordered by Suriname and where they speak Dutch. And so, you know, they were owned by, you know, by the French and they were finally colonized and then freed and independent. But, you know, my mother sort of grew up with all different kinds of cultures in Guyana. You have Trinidad, not too far. You have Surinamese, you have the Dutch, you have the Indian. And that's what created the culture there. But she grew up in a convent. She didn't know her mother and father too well. I mean, she knew of them, but were raised by nuns. And when she was 13 years old, she and her sister moved from Guyana to London. And my mother stayed there for another 13 years. And, you know, she got closer to her father in London and to her family. But she decided when she was 26, it was time for her to go. She was like, I hate this weather. London weather sucks. I got to get out of here. It's depressing me. And she moved to New York. It's funny because her plan was really to move to New York for a little bit and then go to Miami. And she and her friend Carol came together from London. Carol went to Miami. My mother stayed in New York. Carol stayed in Miami. And so,
wow.
And my mother met my father. They were next door neighbors. And then they got married and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a real interesting journey for her. And I look at my mother with such grace and compassion and awe because, I mean, what 26-year-old just says, I'm going to get up, move my life mm-hmm. from one country to another place I've never been to before. I don't know anybody there. And every time I ask her about it, she's like, no, it just felt like it was the right thing to do. It just felt like that's what I should do. And this morning, as early as this morning, she left to go to Atlanta for a trip. And that's just who she's always been. She's just on the go. Didn't matter that she had 4 kids. Didn't matter that she was a wife. She also was a very independent woman. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. And so in the intro, we mentioned your father as well, who, you know, you also get some of that culinary heritage from because he owned a restaurant.
Yeah. You know, but before my dad owned the restaurant, you know, most people today know him as the Southern Chef, and I'm his son. But he was an entrepreneur. You know, he was a guy who ran so many different businesses. My father owned a moving service business. Then he owned a carpet store and he owned a men's clothing store, all at different times in his careers. I mean, he probably had like 6 or 7 different job titles in his lifetime. When he was really young, he moved from Alabama. He was 6 years old. His mother moved him to New York and they were born and raised here. And she was a housekeeper, a beautician, and a chef herself. Mm-hmm. And she did everything out of her house. So my father witnessed, you know, entrepreneurship from a very young age. And I think that my father's mantra was that I will never be broke. I will never have to beg for money. I will always make sure that my kids have a roof over their head, food in their bellies, clothes on their backs. And by definition, if he did all those things, he was being a good father. Mm. So it didn't matter that, you know, he was coming in late and leaving late or leaving early and coming in late. The fact that he was a provider in his mind, by definition, made him a good dad. And that was a hard thing to sort of wrestle with as a kid when your father owns his own businesses and he's out all the time. So, you know, I also say in the intro that that sort of created a resentment for me where I thought, why don't I have my dad home like other kids? You know, why isn't my father at my birthday party like other kids? It wasn't until much later that I understood why he was so committed, why he wanted to work so much, why he was, you know, always at the restaurant. And you know what? Because of that, I found myself in the kitchen with my father, bonding and connecting with him. And, you know, I think that's really one of the most special things about our relationship is that, you know, and I think a lot of kids can relate to this who have difficult relationships with their parents. Mine was certainly a beautiful one, but it helped me to overcome that by finding something to connect with him about. Mm-hmm. And as I became an adult, a man, I realized my dad was just a man. You know, he was just another person that needed to be loved and needed to be, you know, he needed to be cared for as well. And, you know, the food was really the connection for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually the perfect, I actually have this like passage from the intro to your book that I wanted to read. And it kind of, it touches on that. My father defined hard work better than anybody. He had a deep need to be successful and an even greater need to not to fail. He had an addiction to work, an addiction I resented as a kid. He started his days around noon and finished around midnight. He took no vacations, worked on holidays and weekends, and rarely had a sick day. He thought being a dad meant providing a roof over our heads and putting food in our bellies, and that's just what he did. How could a man know how to do something he had never been shown before? He just wanted to be a good father. I found myself longing for my father, and bonding with him in the kitchen became our way of life.
Yeah. Wow. You know, it's interesting. I remember when I first sent that to my editor, and I was thinking, oh my God, did I just tell the truth like that on a page? Did I really just almost open diary style, you know, express that? And, you know, I think that that was something I had to reconcile, because for a long time in the early beginning stages of Son of a Southern Chef, I had only revered my father as being the hero. I had never talked about him as a man. I'd only revered to him as being my savior, not ever as a man with weaknesses and with struggles and insecurities. And he was a complex human being, as we all are, you know, but my father never had his father. And so, you know, he did his best to model for us, you know, what it meant to be a dad. And like I said, that meant a lot of work, a lot of hard hours. I also say, I can't remember if it's before that section that you just read or after, but I also mentioned that, you know, he never took a sick day. Mm-hmm. You know, he was always, always at the store, at the shop, at the restaurant. And so, you know, I think that it gave, watching him do that gave me a reality that people who don't have culinary heroes in their families, they don't know this, mm-hmm. that it takes a lot of work to run a restaurant. I mean, I think I knew that, and I think people know that. But when you see it and you live with it, it's a totally different reality. So now people, Korsha, they say, do you want to help own a restaurant? Oh, I know you want to own a restaurant. And I go, do you want to run it? Right. Do you want to run it? It actually happened the other day. And this, a restaurant owner asked me, and he said, you know what you're talking about. He's like, you get it. I was like, yeah, I'm not getting on that train, buddy. Mm. But, you know, the restaurant was called Baby Sister's Soul Food. It was in Jamaica, Queens, in a park called Laurelton. And, you know, it was soul food. And so it was everything from, like, macaroni and cheese, fried fish, candied yams, collard greens, sweet potato pie, all of that on the menu. And it was a place for community, you know. So even though it took my dad out of the household for some time, it also created this community in Queens where people would go and play music. He had built a stage with large speakers and instruments so that people can come and perform on a Friday night. You know, it was a place where people can just go, students could go and just relax and hang out. And it was only him and my mom who were the staff.
Wow.
Yeah, they did everything.
Wow.
So it created this sense of community.
Yeah, it's so look, like reading through your book, like, you know, you look at the cover and the cover is so like joyful. It's you biting into the shrimp and it's like brightly colored with like this yellow background and sauce splatters and corn on the cob. And you get into it and it's like this deeply personal kind of look into someone who is the result of several migrations and a lot of tough history. Mm-hmm. It's kind of all of these things meeting to create not just you, but also like the food that you eat.
Yeah.
Because it's a mix of Southern food and the Caribbean food and also like New York staples. And it's all these different things coming together. I'm curious if you thought about that while you were working on this.
It's interesting. It's a really interesting observation. I think yes and no. You know, I did certainly know with some of the recipes, like my dad's salmon croquettes, for example, which came out of a can. And I say in the head note there that, you know, we ate a lot of things coming out of a can because that was the food of our ancestors. You know, things came from a can. Even when my mother migrated from England, you know, they still eat a lot of fishes out of the can and, you know, a lot of cheeses and things that, you know, are sort of low shelf, low level kinds of sources of food. So I understood that. But one of the things that I wanted to do was sort of make the story accessible for people who didn't have that history. And to say, okay, you like to throw on a lacy fried egg on top of your breakfast, so I'm going to put that on top of my dad's salmon croquettes and sort of, you know, marry the worlds of deep history with struggle and accessible and inaffordable with, you know, a language and a framework that people can understand today. So there are ingredients like avocado, which my family never used growing up. We never ate avocado, even though my mother grew up on avocados in Guyana. She grew out of it liking it. So we never had it. So those were flavors and foods that I had to sort of grow into. Sriracha, we never knew what sriracha was. Sriracha is in my book. Aunt Jemima is in my book, the product, the brand, because those were things that I grew up eating. You know, but I think that for my generation to read this book and to open it, and even for generations to come, they will certainly get a historic understanding of where I come from and the food that I grew up eating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have, two things. Do you have a favorite recipe in here? And also, do you have a recipe that, you know, someone's like, where do I start? Where do you tell them to begin?
Oh, that's interesting. Favorite recipe? I think it changes all the time. I really don't. I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's to a parent asking who's my favorite child. Maybe there is a favorite child. But I don't know. I think they're all really unique and special.
There's 100 of them?
There's like over 100.
Over 100 recipes in here.
Yeah. So, you know, to underline one and say this speaks to everything this book represents is a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm loving my Bama Mud Pie Mousse Pie, which I've only literally made twice ever. And, but it's one of my favorites. The cinnamon sweet potato rolls on the back cover of the book is delicious. My dad's macaroni and cheese. I think if you open the book, start the drink section, start there. You know, it's like really easy stuff, like five ingredients, like my pomegranate spritzer. People really love that. My watermelon cocktails, people really love. So start there. It's always nice to just sort of start with a nice refresher, a mm-hmm. drink.
And then, you know, look through.
And then look through and peruse and, you know, see whatever floats your boat.
I have to also point out this photography.
Yes.
The photography in the book is, I mean, it's not surprising because you are the first, like, chef on Snapchat. So it's all, like, so visual and really speaks to, I think, the way that people kind of digest food visually these days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, the picture of you with the crab legs.
Oh,
and you're holding
that needs
them
to be
like
on a shirt.
It's like how can I describe it? It's like Edward Scissorhands, but black and with crab legs.
Yes.
That's the best way to describe this photo.
That is absolutely the best way.
And you are shirtless.
I am shirtless.
And you are shirtless
as I am
in the photo.
On most of my Instagram. It's funny, I had a meeting with someone at this executive at a network. I won't say which one, but they were saying, oh, you know, you take a lot of photos in your Instagram with no shirt on. And I thought, yeah, I do.
and
your point. I think that, first of all, I want to acknowledge my amazing creative partner and photographer for this book, Anisha Sisodia. She's at Anisha Spice everywhere on Instagram, everywhere. She and I, along with the team of people who you know, our tribe, we call it, our tribe came together to really, we discussed what we wanted the book to feel like and feel like and feel like. And it all came back to a feeling. And, you know, we were totally inspired by, you know, what we see on Instagram, you know, but truth be told, everybody knows you sort of mindlessly scroll and you double tap just what looks interesting and you're not really getting into the story. And we wanted to challenge people to take time and notice these photos, and we wanted them all to be bold and individual. And I think we accomplished that, you know, but several meetings into what is the feel of it, what is the look of it. And the other thing that we did was look through so many cookbooks, and we were just like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is boring. Oh, that's boring. Love the writer, love the chef, but their food's great, but the pictures are boring. And I didn't want it to feel like, you know, really elevated food on a white plate, like my culinary training teaches me or has taught me. I wanted it to feel messy. Mm-hmm. And by messy, I don't mean sloppy. I mean an organized piece of art on an easel called a plate, or if not a plate, on a piece of newspaper or on a sheet tray. But I really wanted people to get into the art of it, because that's what culinary is. It really is an art. Someone described this book to me yesterday as something that you'd find on a Bushwick gallery wall.
Yes.
And I thought, oh my God, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So that's what I hope, that's what people would take from it.
Yeah. I totally agree. And like, even, you know, you get so personal with this book and your story. And I feel like the tendency is, like you were talking about, how, you know, even if you respect the chef or the writer or whatever, the cookbook can feel a bit boring. And I feel like that's because I think we're told to approach those topics in this very austere way, and it has to be very serious and very it has to have a certain amount of reverence. And this is like respectful but very irreverent. Like, it is very like,
well, that's just me, Korsha.
it's great.
I you know what, I think that was one of the things that writers have told me before writing the book, that you're not going to get your way. It's not going to be what you want. Mm. It's going to be what the publisher wants. And I'm a rebel, so that doesn't sit well with me. And you know, of course, I'm you know, I'd like to believe I'm easy to work with, and, you know, I like to collaborate. That's a fact. But, you know, I really did want this book to feel on its own island. You know, I wanted it to be that way. And I think that's what my work does. That's what I do through my work, through my life, is, you know, I really like making statements. And I don't think about it like, I'm going to be rebellious and make a statement and, you know, piss everybody off. But no, I feel that, you know, there were conversations and are conversations that, you know, we need to have in this world, especially these days in our country, you know, everything from, you know, food and access to food and who's in the dining room and who's not in the dining room. Like, these are the conversations that we're having today. And I think that the work that people put out who contribute to those conversations need to reflect the times. They need to reflect the realness of the conversations that we're having. And they also should challenge people, you know, to step into uncomfortable places. I mean, I have quotes in the book that I talk about forgiveness, and I talk about gratitude, and I talk about, you know, living in your truth. I mean, I've never read a cookbook that's talked about forgiveness. So, but that's, again, that's part of who I am. That's part of me sharing my story and hopefully pushing people a little bit, you know, off the edge. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk about how you use social media to share your message even more?
Well, I have a slogan that I created called Make It Gravy, which I have no idea really what it means. I think it sort of came from the ethers, you know, into my vortex, but Make It Gravy symbolizes...
As you said, comes from the ethers. There's, yes, thunder. I don't know if you heard that. Oh, yeah, there was a little bit of thunder that just came by. So.
Well, we are calling down the thunder here, yep, on the show.
They hear you.
They hear
there.
Me.
Yep.
But yeah, I feel that Make It Gravy embodies the message of my work. So I remember in my early days of being on Instagram, and, you know, I was posting a lot of food, and then I just stopped doing that. I stopped posting recipes and food, and I started posting more of everyday things that were going on. I posted quotes. I posted, you know, here or there some food, but it was really just me and the inspiration I was finding in my everyday. And there were some people who said, "You're a chef. Why aren't you posting food? Mm. You're a chef. Why don't you have any food? You're a chef. Why don't you have a separate food page?" And, you know, I started to challenge myself, like, why don't I do that? Why not? So, you know, with those those kinds of commentary, if you're not really sure about what you're doing, you'll tend to lean into that and try to make other people happy. Then I got to a point where finally working with Anisha, that we collaborate and we've talked and we thought, okay, the feed, our feed on Instagram, our social media, our Twitter, it should all feel like one song, in this big orchestra. You know, it should feel like one song. And the one song that we want to encourage people to know is Make It Gravy, you know, live in your truth, be authentic. And to find inspiration. So whether it's a tweet that I'm posting or some colorful letters, like we have a bunch of different sort of, you know, batches of how we create our work. Or if it's a photo or if it's a dish, you know, there's going to be something there that's inspiring you to be your best self, inspiring you to, you know, live life in style, live more soulful. So that's what I hope to do through my social media.
What advice do you give, other chefs who maybe don't have as big of a following as you do? What do you usually tell them about how to use social media to, like, I don't want to use the word brand, but to communicate their messaging?
Yeah, I think, well, I don't like giving advice. That's number one. But like, you want advice from me? No, you don't. I think it starts with just being yourself. I mean, it's so overplayed. Like, we say that all the time. It's like a broken record, but it really does start with that. I mean, if you're quirky and you're like a little bit like on the edge and you love mushrooms or whatever, like, take pictures of yourself holding these ingredients or, you know, just doing whatever. I think my happy accident was that I wasn't out here trying to make it. Like, I wasn't out here trying to be the next thing. I was simply being myself, and I presented myself to the world, as broken, imperfect, not having everything together and figured out. And it somehow worked for me. So I don't know if there's one way, but I do feel like if you're true to you and you collaborate with people, you know, in your tribe, you find your creative partners who can help you execute a vision. You know, I think that's really helpful. The other thing you can do is collaborate. You know, collaborate with other chefs. You know, I collaborate with so many people, less and less these days, but back in the day, I mean, I had a show called Soul Food Talks where I would talk to chefs and, you know, hang out with chefs. And I feel like, you know, collaboration is really a good strategy too.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. So we're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
We'll be right back with more with Chef Lazarus Lynch.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Located in New York's Finger Lakes region, Ithaca boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation. As the saying goes, Ithaca is gorgeous. The city is home to 150 waterfalls and gorges sprinkled through its downtown and sloping hillsides. State parks and acres of natural lands offer outdoor recreation for every level of enthusiast. Come stroll among the cool ravines, scenic hiking trails, and natural vistas. Ithaca is home to Ivy League Cornell University and Ithaca College, resulting in an influx of new cultures, new tastes, and new energy every year. There's so much to explore, from art galleries and museums to unique attractions like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Ithaca sits at the heart of a blossoming heritage and craft cider industry. Some of these delicious ciders can be bought in market, but many of the most unique varieties can only be experienced with a visit to Ithaca and this great cider region. Go to visitithaca.com to get inspired and plan your trip today.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Akiko Katayama, and I'm the host of Japan Needs here on HRN. By interviewing fascinating personalities in Japanese culinary culture, I try to demystify Japanese cuisine. My guests have included sake brewers, tea experts, Japanese whiskey experts, and sushi chefs. You can find Japan Needs whenever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Okay, so we are back on Hungry Society with Chef Lazarus Lynch. So, you know, we talked a bit about your upbringing and how important dining was. Can we get a little more specific about some of the dishes that you remember? You have this great anecdote in the front of your book about crab legs.
Yes.
This is a common thing. Obviously, I'm obsessed with crab legs.
Oh, but you're from Maryland.
Yes, thank you. So, like, anytime
you
mention...
I mean, you got the real deal.
Yeah, anytime you mention crab, I'm like, yes, yes. Agreed, agreed. But talking about your dad, like, putting a pile of crab legs on the table, melting, like, a big pat of butter with, like, Old Bay and garlic and letting the family just, like...
Oh, yeah, just go in. I mean, that was certainly, like, one of those moments with dad where you're just like, yeah, this is what life is supposed to be. And we took that for granted because that's just what he did, like, at least once a month. He would go to the fish market and buy all this crab. I mean, like, huge pounds of crab. They would crawl in our sink, and we'd be terrified. You know, me and my siblings, ah, there are crabs everywhere. But that was great. And then there was also, like, my mother's saltfish, and she still makes that today. It's just so good. It's dried codfish fillets that you twice boil, and then you stew that down with some onions and tomatoes and water. But it's just there's something about the way she makes it that's just so good. I mean, I make it okay. My brother makes it really good. My mother's version is just, like, the best. We all just love it. Mm-hmm. That was certainly another dish. And then we also, when we would go out, we didn't go out a lot to eat. A lot of our social eating happened at church because I grew up in the church. So it was always like sister so-and-so's this, or, you know, mother so-and-so's that, or brother's so-and-so's, you know, whatever dish. So we definitely ate out like that. But then we would go to the Old Country Buffet.
Ooh, yep. We had one of those in Waldorf.
Okay.
Yep.
The Old Country Buffet. And it was way, way out somewhere in Long Island. And we would just feast. And my favorite thing to eat there was, ironically, the cornbread. I just thought they had the best cornbread. I mean, today I probably think very
You might feel a little differently.
But
now,
as a kid, I was just like, okay. And by the way, if anyone's listening, this was not a savory cornbread. It was not a salty cornbread. It was a sweet cornbread.
It was like a cakey cornbread.
It was like a
cornbread.
Cakey cornbread. Okay. So I'm sorry. I know I'm the son of a Southern chef, but I love me some cakey cornbread. So that was certainly, like, one of my favorite things about going to the Old Country Buffet. And it was also a buffet, so you could just stuff yourself and eat whatever you wanted. So tons of options. But, you know, a lot of our eating happened at home. And then when we would go abroad, it was a lot of, like, you know, foods from London and, you know, holiday food, Christmas puddings, ham and potatoes. So, you know, we had a different sort of experience being abroad as well, when we go to see our family, of what was on the table. Yeah.
What were some of your favorites that you had when you went abroad?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think it was for sure the puddings, the custards. That was, like, very typical holiday foods. It would usually be served with, like, a cake or some cookies, as they call biscuits, and for holidays. There was also, you know, the roasted chickens, which I know sounds very basic, but roasted chicken with the crispy potatoes, which are sort of like smashed fried potatoes. Mm. They are delicious. They are crispy. They almost remind me of, I don't know if you've been to Barbudo. So Barbudo restaurant here in New York. They have those same crispy potatoes. Mm. It's exactly that. It's just literally a fried potato. It's so good. So that was totally memorable. Oh, goodness. What else? These days now I go back and I'm doing all the cooking. I'm, like, schlepping all these groceries from the grocery store.
Oh, great.
But I'm bringing, like, peach cobbler, and I'm making things that, you know, they don't have there. And that's really fun too.
Do you go out to eat much when you're in New York?
I don't. I mean, you know, people think, like, oh, you're a chef, you must know all the hot spots. And people definitely text me. And I'm texting my food friends, like, where should I go tonight? Where should I take my friends? I have no idea. People are like, where can I get the best barbecue? I'm like, come to my house. You know, we'll have some barbecue. But no, I don't. I don't, Korsha. Do you?
I do. Not as often as people think I do.
Okay.
As a food writer. But I do try to at least keep up with what's going on. Not in terms of what's the newest, hottest restaurant, but in terms of getting a lay of the land.
Yes.
Because I've been here for 2 years, and it's still, like, I feel like I've dipped my toe
into you have totally
the
just
New
dipped
York
your toe.
Food scene.
Yes.
You know, like,
yes.
It's not a full foot in. I'm definitely not swimming, but, you know, my toe is in there. It's just so much.
And I don't know if you've noticed this, but I think it keeps changing. You know, it's mm-hmm. sort of... we're not at the restaurant only model anymore. You know, we've sort of went from that to now, you know, folks are doing more cafeteria style businesses. And then we've gone to, from that to like, let's do these romantic cafes that people can sit in and write and have some, you know, coffee and biscuits. And I think today now it's like, oh, we have this rooftop situation going on and there's like a tech company under us and then there's like an ice cream parlor and we grow our own this and we make our own that. I mean, and that's really fascinating too. And there's no longer, I don't think there's no longer sort of one size fits all sort of restaurant business or model. I think that that keeps changing. You know, I have a friend who just opened up a restaurant down in the Lower East Side called S'more, and I mean, it's just sort of this Nordic style eatery. His hours are from like 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wow. And then he's not open on Sundays. And he's really just trying to figure out what the right system is. But people just go there just to hang out. They go there to eat a nice salad. And he's like, we have salad bowls, we have toast. And like, that's the menu.
Okay.
You know, and then he rents the space out to friends to have dinner parties and pop-ups.
Wow.
You know, so it feels like today anyway, in my opinion, that restaurants are becoming more for the community. It's like, I'll take it for a couple days and do what I want with it. But then you can BYOB, you could create your own pop-up party, you can do that. And I'm seeing that more and more. It's really interesting.
I'm curious what you think is next.
Oh my goodness. Well, I think, I don't know, but I think that what's next is, I think that technology is going to intersect a lot more with restaurant cultures. I mean, I know today you can order a lot of food through your phone and through apps. But I definitely see that as the way forward, where people are not just going to be able to pay on their phone or do something like that. But I think there might be a theatrical element to it. You know, there might be a story that's projected on the wall. There might be a virtual reality situation that happens in restaurants today. I don't know. I would say, though, if I were in the restaurant business, and if that's what my next move would be, I would totally be thinking about, how do I create an experience for people that's not just about food? Mm-hmm. You know, I want to create an experience where people are in connection with where the food comes from, with who are the storytellers of these dishes that I'm tasting. You know, how can I learn more about these dishes and recipes? Is there a relaxation area at the restaurant? Is there, you know, what's going on in the bathroom? So I think that people are sort of awakening up to this idea that I go to a restaurant not just to have a good meal, but I want to feel like I'm really taken care of.
Mm.
And I think that's the next move. Wow. But what do I know? I have no idea. I'm no fortune teller. I have no idea.
No, I think that's a really cool idea. I mean, not that restaurants are like workspaces, but you have seen in the past workspaces become, you know, way more thoughtful about the kinds of areas and kind of environment that they're creating for the people that work there.
Mm-hmm.
And so why wouldn't a restaurant think about the environment that they're creating for their diners?
Yeah. And the technology aspect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. So if you had one free day to go out to eat, where are you going?
Oh my goodness. Like on a normal free day, like just anywhere I go? Where would I go? I mean, there's a couple of places in my backyard in Queens. I still live in Queens, New York. Shout out to Queens. And one place is Trin City Roadie Shop, which has great Trinidadian food. Mm. I love Trinidadian food. I just actually started to love it maybe about 2 years ago. And then if I wanted to be really fancy, I'd go to my friend Michael Anthony's restaurant. You know, I would just go there and hang out. And I'm totally blanking on the name. Gramercy. Is it Gramercy?
Oh, Gramercy Tavern?
Gramercy Tavern.
Mm-hmm.
Gramercy Tavern. I would go there. Here's the truth. I've never been to 11 Madison Park.
Wow.
I have never been.
Actually, I have neither. I've just had a drink at that little bar.
Oh, well, you've been.
Does that count?
That totally counts.
Just a cocktail counts?
A cocktail counts.
Okay,
just good. Like sitting in the airport counts where you've been in a different country. Listen, I would love to go to 11 Madison Park. I've heard a lot about it. And I'm not like, I don't need the experience of like, I don't need the bells and the whistles. I don't need this like whole speech. I just need to sit down. I just want to, I'll stage. I'll go in the kitchen and I'll stage. I'll just stand at the kitchen, put on an apron and taste. But, you know, I can't wait for that day. I look forward to that day of being challenged by people who seriously love food and who care about every single detail. You know, I feel like that was a lot of my training, but have sort of moved on in the way that I cook and the way that I create, where I understand that my user is a home cook, but my user is like a millennial. So I'm totally not creating like the way I was trained. And I kind of like that because it takes the pressure off of everything being so perfect and pristine. But oh, I want that experience.
You want?
I'm gonna have that experience. End of this year. By the end of this year, I will have that experience.
By the end of this year, if anybody listening has a connect at 11 Madison Park, I wish I could help you, but I don't. I do not have a connect there.
We'll make it happen.
Yes, it will happen.
The
by
universe
the end.
Will
speak
make
it into the universe.
That's right.
I was waiting for thunder to happen.
I know
at
thunder
the same
was happening
time.
At the entire interview except this time.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Okay. That's all right. It'll still happen.
It will happen.
So, a question that I ask every guest is, can you talk about your worst dining experience? And you don't have to name the restaurant, but you can if you want to.
Oh my God. Oh Lord. You know, I think I've been really blessed to not have too many of them. But I think, oh my God, this one stands out to me. I was in England actually. And I, you know, I was really tired. We just got in. It was my mother and my sister. And we went to this diner to order breakfast. And, you know, simple diner. And, you know, I ordered some eggs and toast. I mean, Korsha, can you mess up? Okay, eggs and toast. I thought, very simple, very easy. So I realized that there was a holdup in the kitchen. And now I could see into the kitchen. And I was just kind of watching and observing and, you know, drinking my tea or whatever I was drinking and talking to my family. And I just kept glancing back at like seeing what this holdup was about. And it just looked like no one really knew what was going on back there. So I finally see one of the chefs open up some eggs, whisk them around, put them in a plastic container and throw them in a microwave.
Oh, no.
So I thought,
that can't be for me.
Oh, that's not for me. That's definitely like that's someone's snack. That's some experiment going on. And he took it out and he sort of stirred them and put it back in.
Ugh.
So now I'm watching. It's probably like 2 minutes in. He's still doing this in the microwave.
Ugh.
So I thought, oh, that's really odd. So finally my food comes out. You know, the eggs are on the plate. They're on top of the toast. And I go to taste the eggs. And I kid you not, taste it like rubber. Straight rubber, and like had a burnt flavor, and it was just like gassy and oh my goodness, it was so bad. And I really, really tried to like take the first bite, and I just said, I can't do this. And I don't like to be this person. I'm really not this person that sends food back to the kitchen. You know, I'm not that complicated, but I had to, Korsha, because I thought this is,
you're like, I can't eat this.
So then I'm like, okay, I'll order a sunny side up egg, because then you'll have to put that sucker on the fryer.
Yeah.
Okay. And that didn't even turn out too well. So,
no.
So, you know, I just was like, you know what? This is what it will be. What will be, will be. I will have my toast. I will have a little bit of the egg whites that I could eat and enjoy. But other than that, yeah. And I just thought, you know what? I'm too tired to make a fuss. Like, what are we going to do now? Are we all going to get up and leave and go somewhere else? So, I don't know. That was pretty recent, but ooh, right?
Eggs in the microwave.
It's just, you don't do that. Ooh. You know, you really take the time. Now, I worked at a cheese shop when I was in college, and part of my job was to make the breakfast sandwiches. And our sandwiches were like, you know, a little bit of a cheddar cheese with some scrambled eggs. And the owner, Jill, my boss, she took scrambling eggs very seriously, as most chefs do. But I remember the first day in, she was like, okay, watch how I scramble the eggs. And she showed me, and she's like, this is how we scramble eggs here. And they're a little under before they go on the toast. And by the time they sit on the toast, they're all the way cooked and they're not rubbery or anything. And you cook them on a low heat, you cook them in some butter or some oil. She gave me the whole lesson. And so, you know, I really value how we scramble eggs, people. I really do. Yeah,
that's your next book.
It's
scrambling.
Honestly,
eggs.
You could write a whole book. There's actually a book about eggs. It's like a thousand recipes for eggs or something like that.
That sounds about
eggs
right.
Are no joke.
Yes.
Yes.
Ugh, I can't get over the microwave eggs. That's so offensive.
Isn't that terrible?
That's so offensive.
Oh goodness.
So my last question for you: if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be, and who is invited?
Oh, I like that question. Well, this might sound, you might not be expecting this. Take me to Red Lobster.
Red Lobster? Where did that come from?
With Beyonce and Jay-Z. Hello.
Okay.
No, honestly, I think they would be great to have company with. I mean, let me talk about my table because I don't know a restaurant yet, but I'm thinking my table would probably be Dave Chappelle.
Okay.
Lonnie Love, because they're hilarious. Questlove.
Okay.
Because he's a connoisseur. Give me somebody else. I'd want my brother there, my older brother Joshua. And, oh my God, who else? Oh, who else, Korsha? Who else?
Mom, maybe?
No, mom doesn't really get an invite because she's like, she's cool. She's down for the homies, but she'd be too quiet. Like, I need people that would like really make me die happy. You know what I mean? Like, Dave Chappelle would have me dying laughing.
Wow, I hope your mom doesn't listen to this.
Well, she'd be there before I get to the restaurant. We'll have tea with mom.
Okay, so you tea mom.
Then to the restaurant. But I think, I don't know, I might go to, I might go to, what's that restaurant? Really, really famous place in Spain.
Not El Bulli.
El Bulli. They've closed.
Yeah, they've closed now.
No, the other place. Sorry, Mexico.
Pujol?
Pujol. I would love to go to Pujol.
Okay.
I would love that.
Buy it out. You wouldn't be buying it out. In this scenario, it's yours for the night.
It's just mine.
Yeah.
I'd have Pujol.
Okay.
Because I've also never been to Mexico.
And you would just have whatever they made for you? Or would you bring certain stuff?
I would have whatever they made. I would bring some bread from Amy's Bread because I love their bread. I'd bring some, like, I'd make Ina Garten, like, make me a whole, like, cake, like a pound cake, and just have it shipped there. Probably, like, a couple of Ina Garten cakes. And, you know, I don't drink Korsha, but I might have to do a cocktail that night.
You might have to. I might.
Oh my gosh. There's this really good place in LA called, it's a speakeasy, called The Varnish, and, they make the best cocktails. So I might just have their cocktail bartender cook up a situation for me, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay.
And send those too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and Whoopi Goldberg, please.
And
come.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Whoopi must be there. Hello.
This is quite a group.
This is how I want to go out on a bang, you know?
That sounds great.
Yeah. And then, you know, of course, I think my family has to be there. They have to be there. I think that the table's getting bigger and bigger, of course.
As many people as you want. I mean, you have a whole restaurant.
Oh, then I invite everybody. All my homies. All the homies are invited.
All the homies.
All the homies. Yes.
And Beyonce and Jay-Z and Questlove.
Of course. Yes, of course.
Lazarus, thank you so much for
being here.
Can you let listeners know where to find you on social media?
Absolutely. I am everywhere at Sun, S-O-N, of a Southern Chef. You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter. I'll be there.
And your book, Son of a Southern Chef, Cook with Soul, is so beautiful.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's really... I think this is a really great, like, testament to not just the work that you've done, but also, like, your family and just who you are.
Absolutely.
As a person.
Absolutely.
So I'm very happy for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Korsha.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week on The Hungry Society.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.